Rita, I'm reliving the same day over and over. Groundhog Day, today.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Coulter, joined this week by the high performance coach of the Victoria Country Men, Brenton O'Brien. Welcome, Brenton.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Good to have you back, and good to have you back in the country. Zoe Carr, the high performance coach of the Victoria Country Women. It's been a busy month.
It has, but it's good to be back.
It is fantastic to have you here. We'll unpack all that probably on another podcast, but we'll try and get you through this one without falling asleep if we possibly can over the course. A reminder to all the listeners out there about rating, reviewing, and subscribing. If you've got any coach shout-outs, you are more than welcome to send those through as well. We haven't had one of those for ages now, so if you have any coaches you would want to give a little bit of love to, by all means, send those through. You can do that at coaching@basketballvictoria.com.au or via the Talking Split Instagram channel. I've now worked out again that we've had a whole bunch of messages sitting in there that I wasn't aware of. So apologies to those people that you didn't get a reply. I didn't know they existed, but we will keep a more diligent eye on that one. As the soundbite at the very start of the pod alluded to, Groundhog Day. Sometimes it feels like we just go through the same thing over and over again, and the needle never really moves in the direction we want it to go through. So we're going to go through just a few of the things that we feel like we keep teaching. Why it doesn't change, and what we can potentially do to make a change in a game in particular. So I've got a list. Obviously, Brenton and Zoe, you can chime in with yours along the way as we go through this. I'm sure we'll go off on various tangents throughout this, because what's a podcast without a tangent at this stage? The one that is front of mind at the moment that I feel like every training session this gets addressed, every game this gets addressed, every film review this gets addressed, helping off the strong side corner with a shooter. Okay, Zoe's obviously pointed at her phone, which I would suggest means that she had that written down as well.
Number one.
I'm pretty sure
one,
I had that too.
One yeah. A, one
it's,
B.
It's probably fair. Zoe, we are coming off a career trip, it'd be fair to say, which again, we'll unpack at a different time. Once DP gets back, we'll talk all things international trips and all that sort of stuff, because obviously you've got your under 17 worlds to discuss, Korea, and DP's over in China at the moment with an Oz select team. So helping off the strong side corner, I feel like happens in every single game, every single possession, it almost feels like, as we go through this. So I think it comes from a good place with someone trying to switch on to dribble penetration from the corner. It's like, oh, I'll do the right thing and I'll go and help my player out that has been beaten. But it just leaves a very, very open three-point shot. And I think if you're in a defensive system where you might be peel switching or something like that, well, there might be times and places where you do that, where you would help off a strong side corner. But by and large, we aren't peel switching. I would suggest the majority of coaches out there would be play it straight up rather than a peel switch. So helping off the strong side corner. Brenton, I'll let you tip into this one because I can feel the rage slowly burning in Zoe at the moment. I'm going to try and let her just calm down a little bit before we fire off over to that direction. So I'm assuming it's something you see a fair bit when you're taking training sessions and games and the like.
Yeah, I think it's something that like we see in the boys a lot. Like I know when we went to Nationals, it happened a lot on both 16s and 18s, and I think the lack of shooting is sometimes something that hides it, but then also the one-on-one defensive like containment rules. Like that's something that we've spent a lot of time on in our SPP and MPP sessions lately, because it's an issue for all of us, is that like just blow-bys and lack of like accountability on closeouts and being able to contain the ball is something I think that causes this a lot, because like you said, everyone's trying to do the right thing. But then once you're blown by, it's just like, who's up? Let's go. Let's stop the ball. So we see it a lot, but yeah, I think it comes down to the one-on-one containment, like, and where are we pushing the ball? Like, I hear so many people talk about underneath the backboard and over the elbows. Like, it works. Like, I do believe in that too. But, like, I've asked kids before and they're like, I don't know what that means. So there's a lot of, I think we're missing a lot of detail on just the one-on-one component that could probably fix that. And we're missing the point where it's, yes, stay on the person in the corner, but sometimes we don't teach the other things around that could probably stop that from happening.
Yeah, it's a good point. Are we getting annoyed with the wrong person? And, you know, I think we still have every right to be annoyed at the person that helps off the corner, because I feel like they've been told don't a number of times. But if we stick the ball better, I suppose, on the closeout on the perimeter or off triple penetration, maybe we're not in that rotation perspective where someone has to potentially leave a corner shooter in that space. Because when you think about the people that tend to play in the corners offensively, they tend to be the best shooters. Or someone they're trying to hide on offense, one of the two, in which case you probably could help off the corner if you knew that was a scout. But by and large, the corner shot is a fairly high percentage shot from three. you know, all the data in all the leagues would say that's probably where they're going to shoot it best from, if anywhere. So that corner three in particular is just such a key shot, yeah. I find. It's okay, Zoe, like the rage may have quelled a little bit in you at the moment.
No. It's very much, very much present. Only because I've spent probably the last month saying that same thing over and over and over again. And it's not just strong side corner, it's strong side penetration of any kind. And this one's difficult, so I give him a pass on this one for now, depending on age. But when there's like middle penetration, they cross split line, then they step up and help, and that's effectively helping off strong side. I've had athletes in the last month when I've spoken about position discipline.
Just before you keep going, you can't see it at the moment, Brenton, but her leg is going up and down under the table. There's like a nervous twitch at the moment.
Certainly not nerves. But I've had athletes in the last month say, oh, so what, do I just let them get a layup? Yes, because then we can coach the next part. There are also so many times, I understand what we're saying about we've got to be better at the 1v1 containment, and yes, we do, but there are so many times where the defender's actually done a pretty good job. They've led them straight down the edge of the keyway, and the drive's going nowhere, and we help in off and collapse off that, either that corner or strong side, and especially in Korea, that's 3 points, like, without even...
Just ring it up just, straight away.
Yeah. We may as well just go down the other end, just give it to them. They don't even have to shoot it. So it's, I think it does come from a good place in the beginning, but I think the unwillingness to change or adjust is, I think, what drives all coaches up the wall. And it's something that needs to be reinforced, I think, throughout all of our... competitions, like including school competitions as well. Like, I know it can work, like was mentioned, if we are playing a team that, you know, isn't a good shooting team, and it can work, that collapsing sort of D. But let's be better than that. Let's coach these kids for where they want to go, not where they are now. And so then, you know, those become habits. We saw over the course, particularly the career group, over the course of that, you know, 10 days, by the end of it, we started getting so much better at it because it was just constantly reinforced. It was in every film session. It was discussed on every whiteboard. You know, it was spoken about. There were, you know, reminders during the game. Even at times it got to the point where as a drive was happening, I'm standing on the sideline screaming, stay at home! Like, you know, it's, but... That's I think where we've got to get to. It's got to be a collective, not just like one program or one competition or one coach.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the ones that is probably a universal rule. Like it's, you can have different opinions on like, and one of the ones I've got written down here, like zone defense being played in youth age groups. Like we keep telling coaches not to do it and it keeps happening. Mm. But people will have their opinions on why they should be able to do it. I think they're wrong, but you know, that's a different tangent altogether. But I think this is one of the universal ones where we don't want to help off corner shooters. And it's your point is valid. I think when it comes from the weak side and you know, you're on potentially split help, dribble penetration comes from the wing and crosses over split line and you become almost the primary defender, you've got to get out of there. Mm. That's not your job anymore because you've got to trust that your defender or the other defender will take care of that. At the moment now, we're sort of seeing, I think probably if you would say under 18s and above, most people will shoot the uncontested three at a better rate or in terms of points per possession than people would a contested layup. So don't give up the three. Like it's worth more points. Not to mention it's just demoralising. Like any time, no one has been happy that a three has been scored on them. It's usually the arms drop, the head slumps, those sorts of things that come with it as well. It is a really impactful basket to make, I think. And it's like, Zoe, I know we were talking about it obviously over the last little bit, and it's like, well, you know, do you want me to help off, you know, give them the layup over the three? Well, yeah, we do. Like the three is more valuable. Well, it's one, points.
Especially in Asia.
It is. It absolutely is. But I think that's one of the biggest things. Like, And Brendan, how do you get it into a training session, I suppose? Like, do you have a coach designated to, hey, do not let them help off the corner? If they do, you know, that's a penalty? Or like, have you found anything that has worked better?
It was a really hard one because we did peel switch for a while, like, yep. Which we're trying to break some habits now, which is like, it definitely helped me in my state team days where we did peel switch a bit, but yep. I think...
Because you're almost just sort of saying, look, you're going to leave anyway, so just leave the system.
I've been a part of the problem, I think.
haven't we all?
Yeah, but I think...
I wasn't going to say anything, but... Yeah, no.
The things that we spend the most time on is how do we break that down into, like, really small-sided games, like we're talking about the layup like is 2 points, and sometimes you got to live with that and you got to be able to go there. And but in juniors, I think it's really hard to get that through to the kids. It's like, well, they're not going to make that three. Like, yes, they're not now, but in 5 years time they're going to make that. And you see it from 16s to 18s to 20s, like the evolution of the player. Like the big kid who couldn't play in under 16s in under 20s can now hit a trail three or can hit a corner three. So it's just really emphasizing that the whole time. Like, we spend a lot of time on like 2v2 with a strong side corner and how we guard that and try and take away the help. So then now we're building on how do I wall up? How do I contain the ball? How can I stunt and get back to that person in the corner? But I think it is important to have someone on that. Like, I know my last state year, we spent a lot of time, like I had one coach that was just on rotations and where we help from and who we don't help off. And I think also it's the accountability piece of it all. You can't say that and then in the middle of a game let them get away with it. Yep. So I'm sure there'll be another thing about boxing out on here where it's...
There is actually, yeah.
But it's the same kind of premise. It's like you get what you allow, and we've got to make sure that every drill we have, there's an emphasis on like those things that we really care about.
Well, and it leads into one of... And I'm sure it's on your list too because we've seen a lot of it. It also leads into re-penetration.
It is actually on my
because
list.
Because yeah, right. That is rampant and... like you said just then, Brenton, like how are we going to become good shooters if we don't let them shoot the ball or we allow them to get away with like, oh, I'm just bigger and stronger and more athletic, so I'm just going to re-penetrate into the paint and score over everybody else? Or, you know, Coops used to always say, clamour into five people, get a foul and everybody claps. And he's not wrong. Like, that is from what I've seen. That happens a lot. And so those sort of things, I suppose they sort of lead from one to another, because helping off the strong side corner probably isn't a problem because we all know everyone's just going to re-penetrate anyway. So it's holding that sort of stuff accountable to the play that they're going to play, you know, once they leave your program. You know, are we – winning is great and we all want to win and, you know, being able to say you've won a VC title is huge. I'm certainly not trying to take away any of that. But I would like to see coaches have a little more pride in, you know, having their players be able to succeed further than just that one season or two seasons at the club or, you know, whatever it is. Let them... You know, give them those, instill those habits and those standards of, yes, this works here, but that's not where you're going. We want you to be able to go to, because even at a senior level, you know, you look, if you re-penetrate even, you know, at NBL 1 level, you're in trouble. Like, especially on the men's side, like, they are some big bodies that you're going up against, that you're going back into the jungle. So... We've got to do a better job, I think, overall of realizing almost there's a domino effect of these sort of things.
Yep, and I think so. Just to be clear on what re-penetration actually is for anyone that's a little confused by it, someone drives into the key, makes a pitch out pass to corner 45, wherever you want to go. That pass comes out, and they just re-penetrate straight back in there. Now, the general rules of split kick and extra would be once you get in there and make the kick out pass, kick it again. Like, you can shoot the first one, that's fine, no problem with that. But if you can't shoot it, pass it. Don't just drive it back into the jungle where it is. It just becomes that washing machine almost of just like, oh, we're just going to drive in here and see what it looks like. And then we'll drive in here and see what it looks like. And before too long, you've got 10 players standing in the key. Zero of them are able to effectively catch and shoot or finish because it's a mess in there more than anything else. And it's, I mean, looking at at the under 16 nationals that have just gone in particular, it's one thing I thought both country groups did pretty well was not re-penetrate. Like I thought the ability to hold space was pretty good overall in terms of not just running straight back in there and trying to go again. Like it's is this something but when does that kick in, I suppose, Brenton? Like is that something that you're trying to put into like academy programs for country?
We spend time in that, I reckon, as soon as we start.
Like Jamboree.
Yeah. I think like I've gone a bit different with the receiver spot stuff lately. We've gone away from the traditional split kick extra. It's still there, but we're more on push-pull row receivers, which is someone drives towards, we move away. If they drive away, we feel behind. Yep. But then we've also adapted that to where we need to have a corner field if there's a baseline penetration and things like that. But just if I've been watching a lot of the Eurobasket juniors lately, like that's been running recently. So if anyone wants some good basketball, go onto YouTube. It's there. You can watch 16s, 18s, 20s. And someone I've watched a lot is the Slovenian teams. Like they've had a lot of success there and it's literally what we're talking about. Like they're elite at finding the next person and then driving the like drive the wake, I think they call it, where you're driving away from the ball to where the space is. So, but we spend so much time on it. I reckon 60% of sessions would be based around how do we play without the ball and what do we do when we catch it. Yep. And that's something that we emphasise and I'm glad that I'm not the only one that thinks we're getting better at that, which is awesome. Makes me feel like we're having some impact. But no, I think it's something you have to spend every session on and like it's a really good way to break down one-on-one drills. How do you go two-on-two, three-on-three, and you can just keep building and building from there. And in the end, that's what comes out of every concept because we're trying to create an advantage and it's how do you play with an advantage.
Yep. And there is the ability to two-way teach, obviously. Mm. Like this does help your defense as well get better at not helping off corners and all those sorts of things. So it's not as if you're just
even
doing
just like closeouts. Yeah, like you're really in rotations. Is. If you're doing split kick extra properly or receivers properly, your defense is generally in a rotation of some sort. Mm. So
numerical disadvantage to some degree.
So your closeouts are part of that. Your push points are a part of that. Your stay-go helps a part of that. So yeah, both sides of the ball can be definitely worked in just that one little concept.
Yeah, and not to mention, it's just more aesthetically pleasing to watch. Oh. Like it's just it is one of those things where, like everyone probably remembers, like that 2014 San Antonio Spurs team, I reckon it was, where the ball just flew around the perimeter. Like it was crazy how well they moved the ball. It's fun to watch.
How about the 2026 career group?
You're still holding your hat on that one clip.
There's one clip.
No, well, that's the thing with that Slovenian team, watching them play in the under-20s especially, like that ball was zipping around and they always find, like if there was no advantage, they somehow found the shape and the spacing to get to a ball screen and do the thing over again and over again.
Yeah.
It'd be like three drive kick extras each possession. And it was like, how do you guard that? Well, it's impossible.
No one's defense is good enough to hold up for 24 seconds. Like, and in particular,
not with 30, that movement.
Yeah, like 30 plus seconds if you give up a no board in there. Like, you will get scored on. Yeah. That's just the reality of it. But you can make it a lot harder on the defense by good receiver principles, making sure the ball moves when it's supposed to move, making sure the ball goes up when the ball was supposed to go up. Like, predictable shots are very much reboundable shots and can be easily flying into your defensive transition. Whereas the re-penetration, where it's like, I don't really know where to go here. Mm. You're not really giving any oxygen to the person that's penetrated in the first situation to get out in that situation. And realistically, that tends to be a guard, I find, most of the time that's driven in there in the first place, pitch out. Where are they getting to? Yeah. Like, and even if we're talking push-pull on that, if you pitch out opposite and that drives straight back at you, that's really hard to run backwards out
if you want to
keep vision on it.
You look at the profile of athlete that plays at this tournament too. Like every athlete, I reckon, in the 20... at that 20s Eurobasket, there would be 200 centimetres plus other than the point guard.
Yep.
And even some of the point guards are that big. So, like, re-penetrate into that, like, there's no room.
No chance.
Like, I remember going to a Boomers camp and watching, they had Bogut, Anderson and Jawai on the floor, and I'm like, there's no space.
Yep.
So it's so important to be able to get them to actually, like, not reset, but make them have another long closeout and another long closeout. So just that ability to play and get people moving, it's, like, I think it's underestimated because in juniors you get away with it.
Well, and the drive, the dribble is easier to defend. Like as much as people get blown by, probably regularly, it's easier to defend. There was a scout we had in Korea where the team climbed right into you because they knew they could defend you if the ball went to the floor. So when the ball was moving through the pass or through cut, that they couldn't defend it. So they knew that. So they'd climb in and force it. And the girls did a really good job of, you know, keeping the ball off the floor. And we saw a real difference in our ability to score, or at least our ability to get good shots. So, yeah, the everyone gets a dribble needs to needs to get out.
The post player being not used a lot is a problem with this too. Like, that's something I think about. Like, when there's pressure, like, we re-penetrate, how do you stop it? Like, I feel like we don't use the post enough for that.
Agree. Like, and it's looking at, again, I'll use under 16 Nationals because it's probably the most recent tournament that that everyone's probably had a little bit of a look at. The best teams are the one that use their post in receiver spots. Like, and not necessarily they had to play through them, but certainly played with them and were able to have that little bit of an opposite read. The post had no problems going to a short corner or wheeling up or getting to an elbow or something like that. And it was amazing how often scoring bigs caused so much chaos in there, because now the help defender's like, I can't leave that. I have to stick with this. So now they can't help on penetration and those sorts of things. So I think the, like, as much as we've probably talked about like receiver spots as in perimeter receiver spots, it's a valid point. I think the interior receiver spots are just as valuable there because it's, you know, it's only a little 4 foot jumper.
Bring back post play.
Well, you know, every now and again, like flared jeans, everything comes back around at some point. The next one, I feel like I spend a lot of time telling kids not to run to the sideline against pressure when they're dribbling the ball in the backcourt. Like, it is an area of frustration of mine that, see, people can't see this, but Zoe is hysterically laughing and Brenton is in the fetal position over in the corner at the moment as he's holding in all of his most innermost thoughts. It is one of those areas where I feel like, for some reason, players feel like if I just go towards the sideline, that's my safe spot. And it's like, you could not be further from the truth. That is a sideline and a real problem if you continue to run there.
The longest defender on the floor.
Absolutely. Like 94 feet worth of you can't go there. And that's literally where you want to run. The ability, I think, for guards to play with a change of pace and a change of direction, not just a change of direction. Like, I'm, again, a little bit of Rob's rant here without the theme music on this one. But I'm sick of seeing what's in your bag as a player. Like, I don't care how many times you can cross the ball over. I care if you can do it once at tempo to go past your player. We don't need 15 crossovers to go past someone. One crossover done correctly will get you past the best defenders. So that is easier done from the middle of the floor rather than a sideline. The only thing worse than going sideline for me is going sideline and then spinning and turning your back on the play to go back towards the middle of the floor. That will have me in conniptions on the sideline. And despite how many times we have said, don't run to the sideline, own the seam, stay in the middle of the floor, use your trailer, play off a reversal, it seems to keep happening. Now, I am respectful of the fact that in the younger age groups, where they probably only have one side of the body figured out by that stage, if they're lucky, up until probably about under 14s, they're going to inherently run to their preferred hand sideline because that's an area of comfort for them. But we also have to get them comfortable with being uncomfortable in that space and using both sides of the floor and just playing with a little bit more awareness, I would suggest, over the course. So, Brenton, give me your thoughts on running the sidelines against pressure. Is it spoken about a lot?
I think I still remember Coops yelling at us about it. Like, just be like, bad guards find the sideline. And he's right. Like, he really is. And, like, I think the amount of times I've said it too, like, it's definitely a problem we have. But I think it's a product also of the way we run offense here. Like, all our offenses run 4 out, 1 in. We want this perfect spacing. But then, once again, I'll go back to the European teams I've been watching. They play through the center circle all the time, and they're really good at teaching that. So I think we don't spend enough time on it. It's something, like, we get upset about, but we don't actually spend a lot of time on how do we work on that. What's our change of pace? Like, I remember being taught if I was going as fast as I could down the court and someone was guarding me is to just stop, because they can't stop as quickly as you can, and then you go the other way. But even for myself as a coach, I haven't spent much time on that, and I probably need to if I'm going to start getting into the guards about that and hold myself a bit more accountable.
Nah, it's easy to just blame the guards.
Yeah, no, yeah. But I think that, like, obviously the weak and strong hand thing's a real thing. Like, I think we do a really good job here in Australia, and even, like, watch our competitions, of forcing to the sideline and putting pressure on that way. That's something we do very well, but we need to, like, kind of make that harder for the teams. And, like, how do we have pressure releases? What do we do here? Like, there's a million things that we could do to fix it, but I still think it comes down to, like, how can we teach them that change of pace, change of direction, where's space, where do we go from here? And I don't think we spend enough time on that in full court one-on-one drills maybe, and some two-on-two, three-on-three, things like that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. Like, I am, again, conscious of how many teams have a full court to training. That may be a legitimate problem, to be completely fair. But there is still some, I think, some stuff you can do in the half court.
Definitely.
To just stay away from the sidelines, because that is my biggest gripe, is you just see a player run towards the sideline, it's like they're getting trapped, like, straight away. And you think about what we teach defensively, which is pin them to the sideline. Why would we want to do something that we're actively trying to get someone else to do on the other side of the ball? Mm-hmm. Like, that, for me, it's counterintuitive. Like, it's, if we're content to pin you on a sideline, why would you run to the sideline when you're on offense? That doesn't make a lot of sense. So, Zoe, you've obviously got similar opinions, I'm assuming?
Yeah, this one drives me nuts because it's probably more constant than the helping our strong side corner. It's just that strong side corner help is more devastating because of the three ball. But I think there's also the – I think if we take it back a step as well, I think there's – from – watching the VJBL, there's too much coach interference. And what I mean by that is coaches wanting a particular play run, so kids are walking the ball down the floor. And so now they're being guarded, so now it's hard, and now they're straight to the sideline instead of just getting it and go. Like, and I used to do the exact same thing, so I'm certainly not throwing stones. Yeah, I used to stand on the sideline and belt out which offense I wanted for what look. And so, yeah, certainly no judgment. But it's, I think it's, like, I mean, we also saw over the last, you know, the defense in Korea was like nothing we would ever experience here, even in the senior levels. It was the most suffocating pressure I think I've ever seen. And the kids did such a good job of adjusting eventually. But they'd catch it, they'd turn, they'd look, they'd stand there for a bit. And the amount of times we got, backcourt violations from just walking, trying to walk the ball up the floor or taking our time, instead of just getting it and go. And that, like you said, that one move and go, or, using the pressure releases. We had a bag of pressure releases in there. Once they started using those, we advanced the ball pretty well overall. But I think there's so many times, like, point guards catch it and they almost look to the – I've seen it so many – they look to the sideline. It's like, what do we run now? And the problem with that is twofold. We're not playing with pace. We're allowing ourselves – oh, sorry, probably three – allowing ourselves to be defended. But then we're not really teaching point guards. You know, if we're having to – and that's one thing I found when I was coaching juniors, was the amount that I would tell them what to run. I didn't tell them why. And then they had no idea of how to be a point guard beyond that. So we're not teaching them – you know, hey, we need this look. We're going to run this out of their own as a point guard. You know, they're constantly reliant on being told what to do.
It's an issue. And it's an issue I'm sure you're both about to face again as the new cycle of, say, NPP, SPP, STP rolls in, because you're about to get a new cohort of kids. And at the risk of going all, you know, punks to Tony Phil on this one, there is an element of Groundhog Day. About, I'm just about to go and teach the same thing again that I've just taught for the last 12, 24, 36 months with a new cohort of kids. So how, I suppose, can we help coaches out there so that by the time they hit these programs, they do know what they need to be teaching in that space? And that's a real open-ended question, because I don't know necessarily there's an answer that is categorically correct, for lack of a better term, but is there anything that we can encourage, whether it be like teaching points, whether it be like language around it? Is there anything that you think will help coaches out there with this?
Well, I think position discipline is massive. And if we can all be on the same page with that, and you know, we're happy for people to come and watch sessions when we're teaching it, or, you know, speak to coaches, whatever's needed. That's totally fine. Also, if we could get that, and if we could get playing through the seam as a point guard.
Yep. So seam, elbow to elbow.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking.
Yeah.
So elbow
play anywhere in there. Yeah.
To both ends. Yep.
God, that'd go a long way.
Yep.
That would go a long way, I think, to helping us with sort of moving them forward once they come in. Now, even if they do the coaches out there do a fantastic job of holding the athletes accountable to those sort of things, they're still going to come into programs and collapse every now and again off strong side corner. They're sometimes going to drive to the sideline. Those things are going to happen, but if it's not as regular as it is at the moment, I think that would go a long way, because then we can go to the next. We can grab them and take them to the next thing. I'd say those two things are pretty big. Outline the re-penetration.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Brent? I think it's also important to be really patient with it. Like, that's the other thing I've noticed, like, and I've been guilty of it my whole life, is like, why can't we do it yet? These athletes take a long time to get right. Like, I put my school teacher hat on and I'm thinking, how do I teach a kid to write an essay? It's not a term thing. It's like year after year after year after year, and we keep building on that stuff. So, like, yes, this stuff seems really elementary and it's like not the cool, like, exciting looking stuff, but it's the important and functional stuff. This is the stuff that makes a point guard really good, or will make a wing really good, or a big really good at what they do. So don't kind of lose it when it gets a bit hard, like, especially if the kids get bored with it. Like, it's how do you make it a bit more fun for them? Like, think of ways to do it, but it's still the same points of emphasis. Like, I think everything Zoe then said then is exactly how they can really help, but it's just be patient and don't, like, it's something that needs to be constantly worked on. It's not something that you work on three times and then it's done.
Yeah, and it's also one to remember, it's not necessarily about kids moving into, say, BV pathways. Mm-hmm. This will help your team play in general. Like, if you're coaching the under 16 sixes, this will make your team better. Not helping off strong side corner, not staying off the sidelines, not re-penetrating, that will make your team better as well. And it starts to look more like basketball rather than sort of a little bit jungly ball at times. What I want to say, it looks like pickup, where it's kind of undisciplined. They do whatever they want, whenever they want. And there's part of me that really likes that style of basketball too, because we are empowering kids to make decisions. But we also know that coaches are there for a reason, and the coaches are to try and get the kids better. Like, so they're not in the 16 sixes, they can make it the 16 fives.
Yeah, 16 that's what I was going to say. How cool would it be if the next year those kids, you know, that maybe go up to 18s and they make a higher team, or the bottom ages then jump up a couple. Like, that's cool. That's sort of, you know, I think what it should be about.
Yep,
absolutely. Makes basketball fun again, doesn't it?
Well, careful, that'll be on a red hat with white writing fairly soon if you if you go down the wrong path with that. You've looked at me blankly.
I get it.
Yeah. Politics, humour. Of course, Zoe's across this. We'll explain it afterwards.
Oh, well, I think but that's where it comes down to. Like, if you're getting better, it makes it more enjoyable, which 100%. Means I want to keep playing. And the goal for all of us is everyone to keep playing basketball, be involved in basketball. So,
without a question. Speaking of keeping everyone playing basketball, communication. How many times have we walked into a training session and it's just been like a library in there? Like, it is just this really serene, beautiful place where nobody says anything and everyone's happy and can read books and study because nobody says a word. There is no communication. There is no energy. There is no vibe to the thing. And every coach in their life or at some point has said, can you please communicate? Can you please talk? Where is that level of just communication that needs to exist? And I feel like every year I've coached, I've had to say it. We don't talk enough. And whether that be off the court, on the court, actually off the court is rarely an issue. I find kids have a delightful time off the floor when they're talking and socializing and doing TikTok dances and all that sort of stuff. They are elite level communicators off the court. But it's almost when they get on the court, they become mute and they say nothing. And it's a level where I just don't know why they don't say anything. Is it because they don't know what to say? Is it a case of they're uncomfortable saying something? Like, I genuinely don't know what the answer is. And it might be different for every team, to be completely fair there too. But I, for the life of me, can't work out why we keep having to talk about communication when it's probably the easiest thing to get right, whether that be the verbal communication, whether that be the physical point go get someone on a high five. That's for the life of me, I can't work out what it is, and it's infuriating. Like I feel like I'm holding it together really well here, but there's some tenseness in my voice at the moment. That is like, this is the easiest thing, and is this like, I worry that have we almost beaten it out of them to a degree as coaches, where we want them to all look the same, think the same, sound the same. So we've almost stifled that level of personality and creativity in our players, where, you know, that kid's a little bit loose and, you know, they're full of energy and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, but they can't be coached. So you have to be this, otherwise you can't be coached. Well, that's not necessarily the case. Their job is to harness those skills and try and make them better in that world. So the communication thing, I am prepared to cop a little bit of a heat on, that maybe we as coaches are the problem with that, that we are stifling players' personalities, which might make them better communicators. But I don't know. Like, Brenton, have you used anything that has helped players become better communicators on the court? Because I feel like it's a real low-hanging fruit that we just never get.
Really good question. I think you're right with how we probably are a part of the problem. Like, it's like, what does a good learning environment look like? And I know when I was in a classroom, we used to talk about this. It's like, is a quiet classroom usually a good one? Like, I would usually catch kids on games when it was quiet. Like, I'd be looking over where there's a little window behind and they think I couldn't see it. But it's like, when they're talking and they're doing things, it was usually a better environment for them to learn in. And yes, you probably don't get through things as quickly, like the content, but I think the most important thing is knowing what you want to get out of sessions, and you need to be really clear on what they need to communicate about. So like, overcomplicated language, like I do it all the time, I need to catch myself, but it's like, what do you actually want? And you need to make it really clear on what you want, and you need to hold them accountable to that. And then all the other stuff you can't really worry about. And I think that's where it goes to. Like, it's easy for me to coach a group that's quiet because it feels like they're listening to me, they're doing this, they're doing that. But are we, like you said, are we actually stifling that? I think we are at times, but there's a million ways to do it. It's you communicating and modelling that properly and doing that, but it's also like keeping it clear and simple. I think that's the easiest way to do it, is like, stop overcomplicating it, less is more, and just make sure that all the athletes know what they have to be communicating about.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, it's your point there about if everyone's quiet, I know they're listening. Not always the case. Like, it's usually they're not.
Yep.
Like, and they're kind of checked out, which is why they're not communicating. And why they are quiet is it's like, well, this is easier for me to be quiet. It's a really good point. And even your point around keep it simple. If you're trying to get them to talk everything, you will fail miserably because they can barely talk one thing, let alone five different things. So it might be a case of, look, dial in on this is what we're talking about. Like, when you're the help defender, this is what we want you to say today, and this is what we're focusing on for this next 60 minutes of this session. That's what this needs to sound like. This is what it needs to feel like. This is the level I want it. This is when I want it. And just get that one right. And as they start to get better at that, that might be a case, we'll now start to reward it. Acknowledge that behavior. And it's like, hey, great talk from Brenton off the ball here. Have you heard them on the last three possessions? And usually the kids will go, oh, yeah, we have. Well, great. That's what I need it to sound like all the time now. And just really, like, a little pat on the back almost for, hey, we value this.
Yeah, reward the right behavior, not happening. It's like, catch them doing something right, not something wrong. And then I remember a coach yelling at me a lot when I was young, like, if you can talk it, you can do it. Like, and I still use that now. It's like, if I hear you talking about it and doing it, it means I think you understand that, or we're at a level where we can keep getting better at it.
Yep, really like it. Zoe, what about you?
The thing that really drives me mental is that when you ask a question about the session, like, you know, what needs to be better, or communication, first thing, communication. So you know, and you're just actively not doing it.
Those that can't see this, Zoe's stance has changed. It's got a little aggressive, like, okay, the arms are folded, the leaning back on the clenched jaw. This is almost therapeutic for Zoe to a degree. It's like a massage. It'll hurt to start off with, but you'll feel better afterwards.
Yeah. I do think in the younger age groups, though, there's just so much going on.
Yep.
You know, in a game. In a practice, I don't think there's really an excuse for it, because you're in a – we should be in a safe environment that, you know, you are expected to make mistakes and those sort of things. But in a game – you know, there's so many decisions, there's so much going on, there's pressure, there's, you know, so I think maybe that's where it comes from. What we saw over the last tour, where we were lucky enough to have Kelsey Griffin and Olivia Pollard come on the tour with us, who just demanded communication from everybody. It was amazing. And the again, the evolution of those athletes was huge. So I arrived home on Friday afternoon. The rest of the group arrived home on Saturday morning. We had MPP, SPP on Saturday, and one of the girls came straight from the airport, which was mental, right? But
respect, like but nothing but respect for it.
Awesome. She got there a little bit late, and the start of the session, and I'm just having to like drive communication. It was almost silent, and then she walks in, she steps onto the floor, and all of a sudden, like the communication level just exploded because of. One, where she's – she was a communicator anyway. She was one of our best communicators anyway. But it's just gone – you just saw how much it evolved over that time. And then she dragged everybody with her. And I think sometimes, especially in girls, and it might be the same for boys, Brenton, I'm sure you can speak to it, but I think sometimes they just need almost permission and not from us, like permission from each other of – you know, you're not going to pick on me if I do this, or I'm not going to look silly if I do this, you know, that. And so seeing those two pros and the level that they expected and that they also displayed gave them that permission. And then, you know, by the end of it, you know, particularly in our last game when we were playing in a smaller venue so you could hear everything was – yeah, it was really special. It was really good. But I think sometimes having someone who can be on the floor and show that level, I think is pretty helpful.
Yeah, it is one of those things where I think they need, as you say, permission. They probably also need to be told what to say because nobody wants to say the wrong thing at the wrong time. So if you can keep it small to start off with, I think that's where you're going to probably have the most success. And yeah, other players might look at them and like, oh, would you be quiet? They're not thinking that when they've just been smacked on a screen. Mm-hmm. They're normally thinking, God, I wish someone had told me that screen was coming.
I remember when we were coaching Knox,
yeah,
and we had one of the junior players training with us and one of our senior players, I won't name them, but one of our senior players got whacked on a screen that the junior didn't communicate. Then she got whacked again on the screen. Third time, that was it. Like she'd given her three goes.
Well, to be fair, after the first one, she did say, hey, you need to let me know when that screen's coming. And the second time, she's like, hey, just like the last time, you still need to let me know when that screen. It was all very civil.
It was, she was.
No issue with it. She was trying to teach.
Yeah, but on the third one, then it was some bite because that third one particularly rattled her cage as well. And so, you know, there was this snap. And
got to tell you, the fourth one got communicated pretty well though, didn't
it? Yeah. And so, but it was, you know, I could have intervened there and just said, hey, take it easy. She's a, you know, but no, stood back, let that play out. The next time that screen came, you would have heard it from Hurstbridge. Like it was.
Jeez. Hurstbridge, you know, reference.
Yeah. That's a long way away.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. And to the senior's credit, once that possession ended, she went straight to the junior, mm-hmm. Yep. You know, gave her a high five, gave her, you know, the praise and all of that for what she did. And so then you saw that the junior, like, because she was, when the snap came, there was a, you know, few
tears. Had no idea with this.
Yeah. Like, but, and it flipped and she was all good. So, I think leaders are so important, like playing leaders are so important in helping that with your groups.
Do you think you can have a quiet leader? Like, do they exist? Like, you reckon that you can, Brent?
Yeah, no. Yeah. I've had one guy who's now in the AFL that played in the state teams with that I had. He always led by example. Like, yep. You could see, like, but he was like he was quiet. He would never yell, but he was okay with friction. Like, he was okay with it being very, like, a little bit of volatility in it. Like, he would talk to them and it was still very stern and direct, but it wasn't loud like it would. But then I also think there needs to be a loud leader as well with that person. So, but thinking about what you just spoke about then, Zoe, is like something that I've realized the more I coach is being okay with a bit of friction, a bit of volatility, a bit of, as long as it's not going too far.
Yeah.
And I think that's where like we're talking about communication, they're probably scared to talk sometimes because they think, oh, am I going to offend this person, or am I going to make them upset, or are they not going to like me? We've got to make an environment where that's normal. And then when you step off the court, it's okay.
Yep.
So I know, looking at our under-16s this year, they were all really good friends.
Yep.
But sometimes that's not always a really good thing. You need a bit of friction. You need these people, like, you are friends, so you should be able to hold each other accountable to things. And that's where I think communication can be lost too.
That's very important as coaches, though, that that friction needs to be fair.
Yep.
So she didn't call the screen three times. So it's fair that she copped that whack. But if it's, you know, blaming someone for something you've done but you don't want the eyes on you, that's when, as coaches, you need to intervene.
Yep, like it. All right, the next one I had here was not finishing a possession with a box out. Okay, so both of you have adjusted your stance in your chairs. This might be, I maintain, this could be a really therapeutic session for a lot of coaches out there.
We see you.
Yeah, exactly.
We see you.
Whatever problems you're having, we're having. I promise you that. And it's funny because I was talking to a coach 2 or 3 months ago who coaches at a higher level than all of us and was just whinging about, and it genuinely was, it was a whinge about, why don't our players do this? And they're like, you do realise our players don't do that either. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you're not alone. Like, you're dealing with junior athletes that, of course, screw this stuff up. We're dealing with professional athletes that absolutely screw up the same stuff. So there's a little bit of comfort in you know, the volume of people that are dealing with this. But even, like, looking through under 16 nationals even, the amount of times that the box out would actually happen at the end of a possession, but everyone will almost forget to go and get the rebound. It's like, you do realise that's part of finishing the possession, is you need to come up with it at some point as well, because one thing to get a body, another thing to go and come up with the ball. And even if you get one right, you won't necessarily get the other. And those rare times where you get all 5 players the box out and then people that go and grab the ball is like utopia for all of us, not like the TV show, but like genuine utopia that we sit there and it's like, oh, that just makes me feel so good as a coach that we've defended the possession and we've come up with the ball securely. Happy days. It's the greatest thing in the world. Why do we still have this problem with players missing box outs and not grabbing a rebound on the defensive end, Zoe?
Why? I don't know. I got to
Well,
be
thanks
honest.
Everyone for listening. No. That's been the talk.
Like, it's, you put it in drills, you rep it, you talk about it, and it just continues to happen. You know, the one that gets me is they box out, but then they slap at it with one hand. It's like, grab it with 2 hands. Grab it with 2 hands. Or they do a great job of like the rebound. I think something we need to teach is the rebound doesn't actually end until you've safely outletted the ball, because the amount of times we see great rebound and then just this little underhand flick, almost lazy type pass that gets them picked off and we end up fouling and it drives me mental why it happens. I feel like
complacency. Like, is that a
I think
thing?
It's. I think it comes more maybe from. I mean, show me 20 kids that love playing D, right? You probably can't. They play it because they have to, not because they enjoy it. They're almost waiting just to play O. So, when the shot goes up, I feel like maybe there's like a switch off of, oh, our turn, instead of, well, no, we're not actually done. We've got to come up with it and then get it to our end of the floor safely. So maybe it's a like a switch on, switch off type issue.
Well, it might also be, I've got contact, so I've done my job now.
Yeah.
It's like, yep, all 5 of you can do your job, but someone still has to come up with the ball at some point if we want to actually come and play offense in that world. Like, what about you, Brenton? Like, you went through under 16 nationals, obviously, where offensive rebounding was fairly prevalent for a lot of teams.
Yeah, I think it's like, I don't know what it is. Anytime there's a transition in the game, it's like it's this most amazing looking thing and everyone just wants to look at the ball. It's like a shot goes up and it's like, oh, the ball's in the air. Or it's like, oh, this has happened. Oh, the ball's there. And then they don't know what to do next. And that, I think it's a common thing in every invasion sport. Like, I think it happens all the time. That's why transition offense and defense is probably the 2 hardest things to do and get right. And it probably comes down to, we don't focus on those things enough and we focus on the other things. Like, I was talking to a coach the other day who's coached college, and like, is really big on advantage play and all this. And I'm just like, well, what do you do with this, with boxing out? Like, how do you, he's like, well, defensive transition, offensive transition. If we get that right, usually they become better rebounders because they transition from one thing to another, to another, to another, right? Because we emphasize the rebounding because that's the first part of any transition. Do we offensive rebound or do we get back? And then it's the same thing. How do we get to offensive transition from that? So it's really like it's a want thing too, like you're saying. Like, yeah. I do agree with that. It's something like you see the best rebounders in the world. What are they like? They're just relentless. Like, yeah. They just have a nose for the ball. Like, I look at Lucas Byrne every time I watch him play. It's just like he doesn't box out half the time, but he just goes after the ball and he finds a way to get it and he'll get a body when he needs to. So it's more of a decision-making thing too, and comes down to how we want to defend, how we want to do things. Like if we're pack line, like there's a longer distance for me to go box someone out. Are they tagging up? Are they getting back? Like, it's just teaching all those little nuances, I think, that really matter. But then it's a discipline thing, like not watching the ball in the air. Mm. Like that's – yeah. The ball's in the air. No one's got possession. Now someone needs to get the possession.
When you don't have to be, you know, 7 foot to box out or rebound.
They're like probably the least likely people to box out, the 7 footers. Yeah. Like, they just don't like, get it because that's what they've always done.
And it's not always the case. I'd love to see somebody stat how many times it's a guard that's coming up with O rebounds, because we always are into the bigs about boxing out, and it's probably easier for them to box out in terms of the space from them to the basket, the distance between their player and the basket isn't as great as it is for the guards. But I feel like maybe there's a bit of a thought process that it's a bigs issue, not a – like it's in its bigs that need to box out, it's bigs that need to go after the rebounds. And often it's, you know, you've got like a three that's steaming in from the three-point line that comes up with it and gets the little putback or, you know, because nobody's laid a body because, oh, the bigs will sort it out inside.
I can't watch another player walk under the rim on the shot. That's the other thing. Yeah. As soon as the shot goes up, like the amount of times I've film, like shown that in film, it's like the shot goes up and they take a step towards the rim. It's like it's a three-point shot. If anything, you should take a step away because it's about to go there. So it's just the little details like that, but I think it is a guard and wing thing, like where we get like caught on the baseline, we collapse. Like that's another thing. Like if we start collapsing, really hard to rebound because now the ball's going to go long because they've shot a three. So it's just, yeah, I think we need it to everyone. It's not just a big problem. The bigs are usually the best at it, I would say.
On the flip side, though, I think I've seen coaches getting into kids for not boxing out when the shot has come off the rim and bounced at like foul line distance. That's really that's really hard to come up with. Like, they're sort of ones where you go, you know what, if you've got a body, we're good. Like, you can't stop everything. But the one, yeah, just straight under the basket or particularly at the, you know, tip of the charge circle and those sort of areas, that they need to be taken care of.
Well, how many times, mate, I might be speaking for both of you, I have challenged openly my players to get a foul on a box out.
Yeah.
Like, I dare you. Like, go and be physical on it. And very, like, one in maybe 60 or 70 times does a foul get called in that situation. Go and be aggressive on the box out. I think the days of we need to put a forearm in the chest of the player, then we need to reverse pivot, we need to try and walk them backwards, they're gone. Mm-hmm. Like, we can't box out that way anymore. Like, we probably have to front check a little bit more, I think, and just find contact to start off with and then figure out where the ball is after that to go get it. But it genuinely is, like, the coming up with the ball is probably the hardest part, I find, because it is. It's the weird rebound that you really struggle with, the rebound that goes over the top of the contest, and it's like, well, how far back can you really push your player out in that? But it should be better with the amount of emphasis people are putting on defensive transition now with, okay, we're sending just arbitrarily two people to the glass, two people to sort of ball pick up and one person to safety. It should actually be easy to box out because three players are almost taken out of the rebounding contest straight away, but O-boards still happen. Yeah, so there's an issue there.
It's interesting. Like, you look, I feel like it's going the other way again now. Like, everyone's starting to send five to the glass because of that.
Yep.
They're like, oh, well, we're going to get offensive rebounds.
So, yeah, we'll take our chances on D-trans.
Mm.
Yep.
Well, that's where there's probably, I don't know, some credit in trying to teach some tagging up and things. Like, if that's genuinely a problem, maybe you need to teach that, like, two-on-two.
Yep.
Not as your whole defensive transition concept, but, like, how do we teach this? Like, okay, where do we rebound? Like, if someone's going to go, like, especially with the guards and the wings on the weak side and the nail – Like, that's where the ball usually goes. So you've got to really teach that part of it.
Well, and there's something too, I think, in a rebounding contest where if you're the offensive team, your job probably isn't to come up with the ball. Your job is to keep the ball alive. Mm-hmm. Like, just if you can get a tip back to a certain area or something like that, that might be something that you're focusing on. And, of course, it's easier to get a tip than it is to secure the ball. So I can see how that would be a problem too. But, yeah, the box out issue is just continuing to be an issue, as it turns out. I've got like half a dozen that we still haven't got to on this, and I'm really conscious of time because we are about to lose the room to another booking. So we might shelve these for another pod.
Part two.
At some point, part two, Brenton, which is always good. You've got a part two. So it does mean you'll be busy a little bit, Zoe, because you'll have to come back for the part two. And you'll also got the international basketball pod that we've got coming up as well. So set your Tuesdays you and Wednesdays
lost a lot
free.
Of listeners.
Yeah, I understand that. That's okay. We do have this week's social split talk, though.
Something to post on Facebook. Let's go.
It's like me on Twitter.
So this is from a podcast I only caught really quickly on socials, and it's Dylan Boucher that's talking. So Dylan Boucher was a New Zealand basketballer. I've got a funny feeling he's tied in with New Zealand Breakers in some capacity there in their front office now, but talking about coaching in general.
I coached high school for one season, and I remember we had a game, and everyone got on the court except for one kid. I can remember the mother coming up to me after the game and asking me why he didn't get on the court. And I gave some answers and I can't remember what I said, but then she kept going, she kept going, she kept going. And I had never experienced this before as a coach, so I was a little bit put back by it. And so I eventually said to the parent, the same energy that you're putting into me and asking me why your son doesn't play, if you'd use that same energy to go home and help your son get better at basketball, he would 100% get on the court. So rather than putting this energy into me, put this energy into your son and help him get better at basketball. Do you have a hoop at home? Yes, we do. How often does he use the hoop at home, and how often do you go out and rebound for him? That's the energy that he needs. And she was really taken aback by what I'd said. And I wasn't rude, I wasn't disrespectful, but it was the truth that she didn't want to hear.
Okay, I took the little bit off at the end that I keep forgetting to take off. Yeah, editing pro, as it turns out. But it is interesting that, you know, one, former player, All Black, or Tall Black, sorry, still get the questions from parents about, you know, why doesn't my child play? I would have thought you don't need to question his playing credentials. Like, as he said, like, was coaching at high school basketball, hadn't ever seen this before or anything like that. But it is interesting how quickly the conversation can be steered in a different direction, I think, in that. Like, rather than meeting it with fire and it's like, your child doesn't play because of this, it's like, well, ask some questions here. Like, do they do the work? Like, what are you doing in this sort of situation? Like, if the onus is always on the coach to try and get a player infinitely better in the 45 to 60 minutes that they get to see them at a training session per week, that's probably not realistic. Because now that player is doing the same amount of work as everybody else in that team. So will they get better if they're just doing the same as everyone else? Probably not. Will they get better if they go and do extra work? Probably. Or at least gives you a chance to get better in that space. It doesn't always equal out that way, but at least gives you a chance. I think that is one thing that we do need to encourage our players to do, is do work in their own time. And I get the whole, you know, their lives are busy, they don't always have time. Completely understandable of that. That's not a problem at all. Like, I do get that. But if you're doing what everyone else is doing, probably expect the result to stay the same. But it's not going to change a huge amount. Now, am I advocating for not putting kids on the court? No. Like, that's obviously an extreme example where it's tied to a high school in a very different environment to what most of us are coaching in. But it is interesting that the first reaction is, why doesn't my child get to play? I'm going the coach. And a lot of the time, coaches don't like to lose, funnily enough. Like, they do like to try and win games where they possibly can. They do like to have a happy environment that everyone wants to continue to come back to. So it is one of those things where, well, okay, if I'm not happy with what's happening, what can I do now to try and amend this? Rather than go on the attack, what can I do to try and find a way to improve my child's chances of getting on the court? Very rarely is that I'm going to go and get them a personal trainer. Like, that is usually the quickest way to a bad result, I find, in that, because usually the skills trainer or the personal trainer in whatever capacity isn't trying to do anything that's going to align with what the team needs. They're just going to say, well, you know, here's what I think. You should have four more crossovers in your bag. You should, you know, practice this 19-foot step back or whatever that might look like. It's like, well, we don't shoot that shot in our game, so that's not helpful for what you need. Usually what they need is just more reps, a little bit more confidence as to what that potentially looks like. And it's, you know, as much as the old 10,000-hour rule has proven to be a bit of a myth, like, you don't just tick over to being competent once you go from 9,999 hours to 10,000, there's something to be said for the work. Like, the work matters. If you put the work in, generally rewards will come from that, I find. So just one thing for both parents and coaches to have a little bit of a think about on that one, where it applies to you, where it doesn't apply to you. You know, it's not gospel by any stretch of the imagination, but just something to have a consideration of as we go through it. Brenton, Zoe, thank you both very much for jumping in. We'll have you back on shortly for what is inevitably part two of Groundhog Day. You know, you see the irony in that. You know, we're doing this again. Thank you both for jumping in. Coaches, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch everyone again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.